Hi, and welcome to Five Compelling Questions with Sean. This is the podcast where we get to know writers and other people from the publishing world through a series of five questions. But people who have been listening for a while realize that we probably ask more like 10 as we get going, because I do a lot of follow-up questions and things. Today, I'm very, very thrilled and honored to have author Chris Chambers here with me. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? Great to be here.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, although I probably could, you know, hang glide over I-70 and get up to your house about an hour anyway, but, you know, it's good to do it virtually too.
Yes, and I actually, if you're at all familiar with the D.C. area, hang gliding is the preferred method of getting to Frederick from D.C.
Yes, right.
Traffic is on 270 is just like notoriously a nightmare for people have spent their entire lives sitting on 70 trying to get to Frederick.
Yeah.
270 and 70.
Exactly.
It's a nightmare. So yeah, if you could glide in, you'll have to do that one day. We can go get a beer. It'll be fun.
Yeah, no, definitely.
We're not that far apart. So I'm going to introduce you real quick to those who don't know you, but everyone should know you. I met you at the bar in BoucherCon, which, surprise, surprise, a lot of my guests I have met at the bar. In BoucherCon or Malice or wherever, but yeah,
it's the best place, you know. It's you know, I mean, I know it's gotten a bad rep because there are so many, you know, crazy and or wolfish people there, but it's also just a good melting pot, and I think it's amazing. I think it's more better in terms of writers, you know, understanding and taking ideas from each other than some of the panels, frankly.
yeah and it is, yeah, it's both those things. But I've been going to the BoucherCon bar for, oh my gosh, like I've been to at least, maybe I'm going on a dozen BoucherCons. I've been going on, you know, off and on for 15 years or so. I mean, I had a child somewhere in there, so I couldn't go a couple of years. I had a baby at the bar is like a good look, you know, for a lady. But yes, but I have met dear, dear friends that I have to this day, you know, it's social events or another at the convention, and panels are also good too, but it's the bar is sort of like you just wander up to someone or a group of people, or you have a friend in common. And I think we had a friend in common, and we just,
right,
see for like, I think I bent your ear for like an hour and a half or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was great. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, I think that these are, you know, cause you talk about just regular human things for a few minutes, but then you really start talking about the business and craft and stuff like that. And it's not just idle, you know, chit chat. I mean, it becomes real stuff.
Yeah. It's networking, and, you know, people have met their agents, and, you know, you talk about your connect. We figured out we were both had a connection to University of Maryland and DC.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's a cool place to go, and you don't have to drink. You can have a soda and lime and just pretend, or just not.
Nurse that for 3 hours. Yeah. But then there's some people who don't do that.
Yes. And they should. And the bartenders love that, by the way. They're like, oh, awesome. Yeah. Some water and lime. Thank you. You know, I will tip you heavily for a water, because, you know, you got to look good the next day and be, you know, not hungover for your panel too. So,
right.
You got to manage all those things at once. It's a lot. Being a writer is really hard. So I'm going to introduce you, finally. I'm going to stop talking so much. Well, I shouldn't stop talking. It's a podcast. Anyway, Christopher Chambers is a Washington, D.C. native and a Georgetown professor. His work includes the award-winning Angela Bivens procedural series from Random House, the pulp bestsellers Rocket Crockett and Shanghai She-Devil, and Black Pulp, the superhero collection The Darker Mask with Gary Phillips, Reed Farrell Coleman, and Matt Johnson. The homeless noir hard-boiled scavenger, he is a contributor to the best-selling Marvel prose collection Black Panther, Tales of Wakanda, and the BoucherCon 2018 Anthony Award-winning The Obama Inheritance. He contributes content, crime reads, noir city. You just have so many things, I need to get them all out.
Thank you.
Contribute content to Crime Reads, Noir City, SiriusXM, NBC News, and MSNBC. So you are a total slacker. You don't do anything. Nobody's heard of you. No.
You're everywhere.
You're everywhere.
Yeah. You know, I just drink beer and watch TV, really. That's what all that means.
Play with your dog.
Yeah, deal with the dog. Yeah.
My 10-year-old son is a huge Black Panther fan, so he's gonna be thrilled that I'm talking. I know you.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is actually the hardcover right here. So, it came out in April, I think, or not? Yeah, first day of April, I think. Yeah,
that's all that long ago.
Yeah, it's a you know, so I'm pretty happy with it. I'm the only mystery or crime writer on the ladder here, and I asked the editor and everything why that was, and they said, you know, they liked that background, but I also had done other stuff, and so the combination of the crime writing chops and the, you know, the pulp and other chops, superhero stuff, it gives me a chance to really combine those voices. So I was really, it was fun. It wasn't a challenge for me. In other words, it was more fun to try to come up with something.
Oh, well, that's cool. So do you see a lot of correlations between the crime writing and the other types of writing that you've done? This is not one of the questions.
this is 5.1. There are. I mean, it, especially if you're doing a short story, or if you're doing, you know, I mean, some of these guys like Gary Phillips and Alex Segura can tell you that it is totally translatable into writing comics and graphic novels. However, I think it's the discipline of writing a short story, because I think a lot of thriller and mystery writers are very good at that, and are good at having to deal with that dual burden of plotting it, but also having, you know, compelling characters that you can put your thumb on them really fast, because you've only got a couple thousand words. Whereas I think with some of the other writers who might be in sci-fi, fantasy, futurism, you know, they have a lot of their tradition is really developing a whole universe, really. I mean, technically, sometimes a whole universe, and that takes a lot of time to develop.
Yeah.
I think the horror writers, there are two horror writers in this collection. I think that their skills are probably much more comparable to thriller and mystery writers. And of course, I'm not downgrading or degrading the other genres. I'm just saying that they have, you know, their creative process is a little different. And so I thought, you know, it was a little less of a challenge to me to try to get these into a couple thousand words and create a universe, create a characters, and create a plot, than I think they probably thought it would be for me. Because I was like, I'll just think of an idea, and I said, okay, let me just run with it. So,
yeah,
you know, but so, you know, I think it's a good stew of a lot of different stories, and, you know, this is this is Marvel official stuff. So,
yeah.
You know, the one thing I wasn't used to, however, was having, you know, the publisher actually, not the editor, but the publisher actually, you know, saying, you know, well, you know, why don't you move this word here, because we might use this in a movie or something like that, you know. We want it to all fit, you know, lockstep into this universe that they've created.
Yeah.
So that was a new experience, but, you know, it wasn't a bad one. It was just kind of like, wow, you know, like, who's emailing me?
Right.
It's not, you know, it's like, what did they want? You know, it's like, well, you know, we might use that in the script, so we want you to just do it this way, and then that'll be a handoff to this. And I'm like, oh, okay, all right, yeah. Well,
that actually kind of folded nicely with the first question I had for you, is how did your writing career get started? Because it seems like this is a new situation, but you've been in many situations and you had a starting point.
Well, I always wanted, you know, I mean, everybody, when they're a kid, they want to try to do something, whether it be art, you know, drawing and words or just artwork. I wanted to be a lot of things, you know, through high school and college. But I always had parents that said, no, it's not practical. And then then eventually I went to law school. And back then, being a lawyer was like, you know, it was like the John Grisham thing, you know, it was like the thing to do,
mm-hmm.
even if you didn't want to do it. And like John Grisham, they said, there was a joke that said on the, you know, this is going to date me, you know, in terms of computer hardware, but they said on the C drive of every lawyer, there's like a novel that's never going to get done. So you just, and, but I always liked mysteries and procedurals and stuff like that. And I just started just banging it out and doing it. And I was lucky enough to be around a lot of people in New York who knew agents and stuff like that. And I was able to write the first one, Sympathies for the Devil, with Angela Bivens, who's a Black female FBI agent. This was 2000, 2001. And it came out in 2001. Unfortunately, it came out on September 11th, 2001.
I was going to, oh man.
Yeah, so that's that. Well, it gets better. The sequel came out on March 13th, 2003, which is the day Bush invaded Iraq. So we had to cut our my launch party. We had it down by the Marine Barracks in Washington on 8th Street, if you're familiar with that,
yeah.
Which is one of the first areas that got a lot of these gentrified bars. And we had it at a nice bar there called Starfish Cafe. And, you know, we were having people come in and everything. And then it was like that movie with Clint Eastwood, where he was the Marine. I'm trying to remember what it was. Heartbreak Ridge, where,
oh, yeah,
you know, everybody's having a party and all of a sudden some siren goes off. I mean, you know, and these random Marines were coming in, and like, because it was a party, you know, they didn't know it was a book party. Yeah. And all of a sudden these guys came and said, "You gotta go. And they just took off. We're like, what the hell is going on? And somebody turns the TV on over the bar. And luckily I've sold maybe about 25 books. It was about 9:30, and then there's W up on the screen. And then, you know, I think I sold maybe one book after that, and people were like panicking. Okay. Like, what's going to happen next? So
yeah.
Bad timing, you know, it's, you know, I mean, Scavenger came out during COVID, but a lot of people's stuff came out during COVID. And I think that, you know, it's a testament to readers and our genre, mystery people, you know, that we chug ahead. So,
yeah.
But I got started there in the early 2000s, and it was tough. And I also have to say it was tough doubly for me, because I was an African-American writer in a genre where there was just basically Grace Edwards, Valerie Wilson Wesley, Penny Mickleberry, Eleanor Taylor Bland. I mean, that, you know, that's a handful of people. That's not a lot of people.
Yeah.
Walter Mosley had yet to become, you know, the godlike figure that he is. And, you know, Gary was starting out, Gar Haywood was just starting out. So it was hard not to be either ignored or pigeonholed. So I had to deal with one or the other.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I'm really happy with the success people are having now. But I wish, you know, they would think about us old folks every now and then. They kind of laugh at us or bypass us, you know, we're the, you know, especially like Gary and I are sitting around like we're in rocking chairs talking about the good old days, and they're writing these super sophisticated, highly anticipated cozies, you know, and getting, you know, the movie deals or the accolades. And, you know, we're sitting there with our corncob pipes, you know, going back and forth. Well, I remember we didn't have that, you know, that's how I think they think about us. So,
yeah.
You know, as we get a little love, you know.
So. Yeah. Well, we still love you. I mean, I, you know.
You have to
always appreciate the people that laid the groundwork for the new generation to come up and reap some of those, you know, there's still challenges for everybody. Yeah. But it's nice that they wouldn't be where they were if the groundwork hadn't been laid in the first place.
Well, I mean, and I tell people, I said, look, you know, I try to be inspirational, because this was in the early 2000s. This was, you know, right by 9/11, and I got a deal from Random House. Okay. And these were hardcovers, you know, yeah. This was the days of hardcovers. So, I mean, I said, you can do it. You know, even though it's a different time, you can do it. It can be done.
Yeah.
You know, and so I try to be inspirational on that level to younger people, even if they have a pretty successful, you know, career as it is. I mean, there's always something new to learn.
So that's what you would, yes, that's how you think about them. But what would you, as a young person, tell yourself, your future self, when it came to your writing? If you could tell yourself anything, start, you know, from the very beginnings, what would it be?
I would tell myself to not listen to people about staying in a certain groove That being said, what I mean is I would tell people, I would tell myself, get a day job that is conducive to your writing. Mm-hmm. Don't do your writing and try to fit it into your day job.
Yeah.
And that's, and really just, you know, interact with people on that level.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what I would tell myself, my younger self.
Was it hard to be a novelist and working as a full-time lawyer? I mean, you've done a million things, professor.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. It's hard now. I mean, it's hard, you know, and I'm not even really in the classroom anymore. I work for, we do international conflict resolution now. I only have one seminar a semester. And that's why that all sprang to mind immediately, because yeah. I've never, you know, but see, life happens. You know, you get married, or you have kids, you have a mortgage, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that the trajectory of my life would have been a little different had I popped in and followed that. But you know, you have that philosopher's existential question. Well, I never would have met my wife. I mean, what about the kids? You know, I mean,
right.
But there's, you know, my grandmother used to say that the people that are in your life would have come into your life in different forms.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's not like you're blinking people out of existence,
right?
You know, into this dark, you know,
that might be tempting, but no.
Yeah. Yeah. This dark hell, you know, it's like, what about my son? It's like, well, he would have come as a friend, or he would have come as another another child in another relationship or something like that. Yeah. There's a school of thought that you know, but you don't, you know, but people don't want to go down that road. I mean, you want to be happy where you are. But if you are given advice to yourself and you answer that question, obviously you're going to change the timeline,
mm-hmm.
you know, one way or another. So you might not meet a spouse,
yeah,
you know, but the other side of the coin is you might have parents that might live longer, or you might save somebody's life, or your books will turn somebody's life around that you haven't touched now. So yeah. it's probably the toughest question to answer.
Yeah. I just sat and watched, because sometimes it's just one and I'm just doing other things and wrapping gifts or whatever, but I actually sat and watched It's a Wonderful Life this year for the first time in a really, really long time.
Yeah.
And so like I was sitting there, I was crying and moved. I'm like, what a cool, you know, plot for someone thought of way back then to write that, you know. It means a lot how incidentally we touched, you know, people, and you never know what that impact has on their life down the road. Because I've had people come back around years and years and years later that said that something I said on a panel somewhere, whatever, inspired them to sit down and do something or put a story together. And then they've gone on to win an award or done whatever. And it's like, I don't remember saying that. I mean, I probably, that sounds like something I would have said, but I don't remember that as, sense, you know, I'm glad I said something good, but you know, you never know how you're going to impact the rest of anyone else around you, or, you know, even minor things, much, much less the bigger things that you're speaking about. But
right.
It's, you know, but I like your grandma's, I love that. I love that thought that everyone is around and will be around anyway, depending, regardless of your choices. I love that. I'm going to use that.
Good.
It makes me happy. Hang on to that one for myself. So this is going to be interesting. I cannot wait to hear what you say. When did you first realize that words have power, not superpowers, powers, that something that you wrote had an impact on someone or a situation? I was just talking about something like that. So what do you think? Did you have
because of my background, I have to divide that up. I mean, you know, with fiction, it was when I was early on, writing, one of the pulp books, the Shanghai She Devil one. And I realized that we had to use a model, this 40s and 50s model. And then I realized later this year that model, you know, it could be very hurtful to people.
Yeah.
Because even though this is, you know, particularly, you know, if you're Asian, and you see, these old pulp magazines, these old pulp, comic books, movies, where you have the sinister, Asian person, you know, Dr. Fu Manchu kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Or this dragon lady thing where they're, you know, they're wearing the, now I forgot the name of the actual dress because I used the word like 800 times in the novel, but I'm forgetting it, but the very tight silk dress that's buttoned up to here. And then she's got the, fingernails and everything. And I realized on the cover of the book, that's exactly what I had. Or the publisher had actually put that on there, but I mean, it was supposed to be a homage, ironically, to comics in the 40s and 50s, particularly in the 50s, around the Korean War, and around the first comic was around one of the first black fighter pilots who piloted a jet in that war. You know, jets were something new, so I was hyper focused on that, and not the other words or images. So that affected me quite a bit. In other walks of life, you know, it's anything. It could be, you know, if you're, you know, I teach, and whether you're teaching kindergarten or college students, you know, words can be hurtful. I mean, even if you don't think that they are, but they can also be important, you know, just in implanting the seeds of creative thought in people. Mm-hmm. Where the person will tip their head and go, oh yeah, I didn't really think about it that way, and trying to teach them to be strong, because we're in a position these days where, you know, if you tell somebody something, it's like, this is kind of what really happened, and they tilt their head and goes, yeah, I didn't think it that way, but their peers or their parents or some other people is like, oh, you're indoctrinating them, you're passing off propaganda to them, and you know, it's like, well, you know, I don't think I am. Maybe you are, you know, but maybe neither of us are. Maybe, you know, maybe we're not, you know, parsing any kind of reality at all, you know, but yeah. Let's talk about it. So
yeah,
that's how I usually answer that question.
Yeah. Yeah. Open dialogue is always a good thing, and having your own thought patterns about things and being resolute in your own decisions.
Yeah.
Taking in information from all, you know, different opinions is always good. You know, we should be able to talk. So how do you develop, you've done so many different, you've written so many different kinds of things and, kind of all over the place. So how do you develop the voices of your characters? Do you keep a Bible or use some other methods to, help bring your characters to life? How do you bring people to life that we've
well, I probably do a Bible and an outline up until this one point, this when I wrote, Scavenger.
Mm-hmm.
And, it came about, and you know, some people love it, some people hate it. Publishers Weekly and all these other people love that, this methodology. Some people said it was hard to get through, but I wanted to write, to do a quintessential Washington based novel, you know, based, you know, what Hammett does with San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that. And I turned to the mentor for that, which would be George Pelecanos.
Yeah.
I think that George Pelecanos, you know, and he's, you know, now he's in TV and film. I mean, he was writing scripts for The Wire. He showruns for the Deuce on HBO. He's got another show coming up, and he and David Simon, who's married to Laura Lippman. So they're in kind of a triad, David Simon, Laura Lippman, and Pelecanos. He's probably a lot closer to being a mentor in terms of craft and subject matter and style than, say, Walter Mosley. I know a lot of people cite Walter Mosley. I do, but I don't cite him as a mentor. I cite him as a, you know, inspiration, but in terms of closeness, it's Pelecanos. I also think Pelecanos is underrated, and I happen to think I'm underrated. So, but that's just ego. But that aside, he said, you know, if you're going to write a book about that, it's tough because, you know, the city is different. The population is different. There's a lot of things that are, you know, he even joked, the gangsters are gentrified. So, and a lot of them are gone. A lot of them are dead, or they're old, and they're like elder statesmen now that people talk to, yeah, you know, for Washington Post articles. And so, you know, if you're going to do this, you got to really drill down deep. And I discussed, you know, about the, you know, homeless, you know, homeless, you know, people are addicts, alcoholics, some of the severe mental problems. And then on top of that, I said, you know, how am I going to make this interesting? And I came up with the idea from another DC writer named Kenji Jasper, who wrote a book called Drop. And he actually was nominated in a short story for the Edgars about 2 years ago, two or three years ago. And he wrote a novel called Nostrand Avenue entirely in second person. And I kind of fished that idea around people like Gary, you know, Phillips and all in there. And they were like, good luck with that. that's a minefield right there. Good luck with that. And I talked to Pelicanos too. And he said, you know, if you really want to make this work, he said, the irony is if you have a protagonist who's homeless, the second person probably actually will work because, you know, whether he's just disassociative or downright schizophrenic or high all the time, you can inject a voice in, you know, and have the voice in his head as the narrative. Right. So I have a second person narrative going where, you know, instead of I walk through the door or he walked through the door, she walked through the door, you walk through the door.
Wow.
You know, and it's not even past tense. It's present. You walk through the door. Do you see anything? No, because you're stupid. You know, and the voice can be a very unreliable narrator too, which makes it even more interesting.
Yeah.
I think the problem is the reader definitely has to do the work and kind of, but I think I introduce it, boom, right off the bat, something's different here in the first three lines. And the readers that I've talked to at book clubs or, you know, a lot of it's, of course, virtual signings, the ones who appreciate that stuff are really, you know, it gets into three groups: people who don't like the subject matter and don't like the narration. Then there are people who love the subject matter, but don't like the second person. And there are people that love the whole package. So, but, you know, so if I got 2/3 of people right there, then I'm happy. The rest, you know, fine, you know, there's plenty out there for everybody to read. You don't have to read my stuff.
Yeah. Well, how does it make you feel when you get like you said you got really positive, wonderful reviews from trades, and how does it make you feel when you have both ends of the spectrum for reviews? Does it make you feel like how does it make you feel?
Well, I mean, any author can give you the number of answers to that. I mean, anything negative is going to make you feel bad. Like, what if I should have done this or should have done that, you know? But it is what it is.
Yeah.
And if you can, you know, if you can touch some people, you know, I mean, I think, you know, if Publishers Weekly did a feature on me and the book, you know, I mean, you know, if I could touch some people and then have, you know, and peers and some publications, say, you know, I mean, good publications, you know, say this is a crazy ride. This is a must read.
Yeah.
But if there's some people who get the galley and are more locked into a more traditional viewpoint on stuff, then I can't help that.
Yeah.
And if there are people that don't like the only legitimate thing that I kind of scratched my head on and said, okay, you know, I really have to thread the needle here, so I don't know what else I could do, is there is a lot of street slang in the book. And, you know, I wanted to, now some people say it's cinema verite, you know, and even Vince Keenan, who writes, Noir City, said, you know, that is what it is. It definitely does. It definitely appears, and it, you know, and it probably will slow some people down. But I think if you look at the context and you look at the characters, and you know, there's a bunch of people gathered around homeless people, half of them high, half of them drunk, you know, and in both sets with some set of mental illness, you know, there's going to be, you're probably going to need to look at the context to kind of understand what they're saying.
Yeah.
They're not going to be speaking the Queen's English.
Yeah, it would be so weird. If it wasn't authentic, it would be odd, you know.
But Paul Thomas and David Simon said people had that complaint about The Wire.
Yeah,
you know, because it was a totally different universe to a lot of people, and then you had a language that was being spoken even the cop speak was different. It wasn't the Law and Order sanitized cop speak. It was total cop slang about everything. So I don't apologize for that. I know I could probably do better, and I am in the sequel. But I'm doing better in the sequel because my character is a lot more clearer headed. He's rehab now. He's trying to make his way in a normal world, in a quote normal world now, where he didn't before. So obviously, you know, things are going to be different. There is a lot of street slang in it, but it's not as focused as, you know, this total underbelly under subculture that it was in Scavenger in this first novel. So, it is what it is. And I just leave it out for people. And, you know, I'm not trying to write to a formula. I don't think Pelicanos did. And, you know, that's what I do, So.
Yeah, well, clearly you're not writing to a formula, which is amazing. We love that about you. Well, I guess my question, I wanted to ask the question because I'm surprised to say you feel bad, because you want to feel bad if it was like an obvious mistake that you made or something like that. But sometimes I just don't think people are quite getting what we're trying to do. And especially when you're doing something a little bit more experimental like you are.
Yeah.
With this, I guess you could call it a bit experimental, right?
Yeah, it is. No, it's totally, that's accurate. That's totally accurate.
Yeah. Well, I think it's great. And I'm so excited there's a sequel. That's really cool. Yes. Okay, we'll talk about that at the end. So I know you write about Black Panther, which we already kind of talked about. If you could have any superpower, what would it be? And I'm going to guess it would be like telling the future, so you wouldn't have book releases on days where we're having catastrophic events are happening.
Yeah, I'm thinking, you know, the next one will be like a live volcano or something, or not, you know, or the Yellowstone super volcano or something. I struggled with that, and I think I would like to be like Professor X in the X-Men, because, and here's why. It's because I think it would test my moral grounding every damn day. Because you could think about this power. You can read people's minds, tell whether they're the truth or not, and then you can also influence them to do stuff.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, how would I... That's what always intrigued me about that superpower. It's like, you know, because like when you were a teenager, I mean, imagine if you had that.
Yeah.
Imagine if you were a toddler and had that, my God. So, you know, but, and of course it would be raw. I mean, and you see that played out in some, like, I think in the last Superman movie, the one that plugged into Zack Snyder's, Justice League, when he was little and he was in school, and he would hear people's thoughts, and he could see through walls, and his mother had to come and basically train him to go into a small place.
And it
would really test out what moral groundings my parents gave me, whether I could stay on a moral even keel, how much I would deviate from that to create bestsellers,
yeah.
You know, or make people read it, make people buy it, make critics who don't like it, or, you know, other authors who kind of poo-poo it, you know, make them go jump in a lake, or, or, you know, write, you know, some really crappy novel. So everybody's like, well, what is this? You know?
Yeah.
It would really, or whether I would misuse it. And I'm afraid of misusing it with good intentions. Yeah. And that's what's scarier than misusing it with bad intentions.
Yeah, for sure.
So yeah. I would want that superpower because I would want to test myself.
Yeah. Well, I think you'd do okay.
I don't know. You don't know me that well. But.
Yeah, we're totally each other. No, I know you're a good guy. But I remember the first Superman movie, the 1970, maybe 77 one. I was a little kid. The Christopher Reeve.
Yeah.
He was my Superman. I still love him. And
I do too. He's mine too. I mean,
yeah. We're contemporaries. The big the line in that one was, with great power comes great responsibility. That's what his dad told him. You know, his Earth dad told him. And I always remember that as a little kid. It's like, yeah, that's true. And it's true in anything we do, you know, any kind of whatever minor little power you have, maybe in your, just your own household, like you have to wield it with, you know, you have to be careful, cautious.
Yeah, you do. And, you know, you have to be careful. And I think a lot of people these days just aren't careful, or they think that their whole universe is being threatened, and it really isn't.
Yeah.
Or it is, and they just don't want to respond because they don't know how to. And it's, you know, it's tough. I mean, I always, that character always intrigued me. It was never my favorite character. And you see, I guess it was the X-Men. I mean, you see what happened to the other one. Was Jean Grey, who had that same power, but multiply it by a million, and she just self-destructed.
Yeah.
And so it's tough. I mean, I don't know what I would do. I mean, between you and me, I think given my personality, and I don't know if I'd have the same personality, but I would probably use it negatively for small petty crap. Like if I, you know, like if I don't feel like, you know, paying toll, I would just, pay the toll, or I'd go into Giant, get a bunch of steaks and just walk out, you know, I mean, you know, but I wouldn't actively be robbing the place and stuff like that. I would probably use it for little things like that, or for practical jokes.
That's really,
I think it would be a great power to have at Bowser Con.
You just came up with a new TV pilot for NBC for minor crimes done right. By your powers.
Right.
You off in traffic and like you grow a green mustache or something, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Little things that I love that idea. Great concept. That's cool. Let's work on it. We'll co-author it. It'll be fun.
Yes.
I'll come up with the bizarre things and you can write it and use your connections to get it published.
Right. We'll see. Yeah.
All worked out. Okay. Well, at the end of the five questions, which always ends up being more like 10, I do a quick quiz. Do you want to take a quick pop quiz?
Sure.
Pop quiz. Okay. So I always find this very interesting just to see what people say. And there's no wrong answers. They're all wrong. Nothing you say will be right. So beach or mountains?
Beach.
Okay. Me too. Cake or pie?
Cake, because my wife's not listening. Cake.
She's not going to listen to your podcast? Come on.
She will, but she's not now. So you can't bust into the rooms of pie. First of all, you can't have either. Second of all, pies are probably better for you. So cake all the way.
You're going to get in trouble like retroactively. Okay, good.
Yes.
All right. Morning person or night owl?
Night owl.
Cool. I used to be, but then I don't know. I guess I'm both. Dogs or cats?
Oh, dogs.
Yeah.
Dogs. Sorry. unless it's a panther or a lion or a tiger. No, no.
There you go. A big cat. You like big cats.
Big cats, although when we were out at, we're staying near Wisp in Western Maryland, we saw a lynx.
Ooh,
and that was pretty cool. The dog saw it too, and even he was like, wow, that's a crazy looking cat. And I was like, yeah, don't mess with it. And it was very crazy because it was at night and the moon was out and it was running across the snow. It was beautiful, yet eminently frightening at the same time. But you could tell it was a lynx. It had the ear and the fuzzy face, and that was crazy.
I was gonna say, you could tell by the way it was like tearing my leg off now, Kate.
Yeah, right. That too. Right.
And for those who weren't on the pre-recording, Chris's dog is a gigantic German Shepherd. So if he was a little nervous, then you know that was a
nervous. Yeah, he was nervous. He was like, wow. Yeah.
Okay, and then the last one is coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Yeah.
Coffee, all the way.
Cool. So tell us about the sequel and whatever, anything else that's coming up next for you. What's going on? What can we look for?
Well, I'm trying, right now I am trying to get the sequel to Scavenger done, and it is the same character, Dickie Cornish, who is now more cleaned up, more rehabbed, has his own apartment thanks to the city. Is going to his appointments at the VA, taking his meds, and trying to be, he wants to be a gumshoe. He wants to be a Seamus, and he's trying to make that work. And he's followed after he tries to buy a bootleg bricked iPhone, because that's what people do on the street here, by this guy who wants to hire him, who looks as down and out as he is. He's an ex-con, wants to hire him to find his daughter who was disappeared, and the kids of a lot of other people that he lives with who are squatters in a pretty messed up hotel, the ones that you would see, especially those of you who live in the DC, Maryland, Virginia area, coming into New York Avenue. You see those kind of old squatter hotels. A lot of them have been bulldozed, but a lot of them haven't. And mayhem ensues. I can't give you any more than that.
Nice.
But a lot of ties to crooked cops, a lot of ties to kind of a reverse QAnon kind of a thing. And he finds himself in the middle of that kind of war, like he did in the first book, where he was swept off the streets and cleaned up and given a task to find somebody that it turned out he already knew who they were, and that's why they picked him. You know, it's basically, you know, he's him coming into his own. The title tentatively is Bellerophon, a scavenger mystery. And Bellerophon, my publisher is Greek. He was one of the Greek heroes.
Oh, okay.
But he was not, he was one that was kind of thrust in that position. He wasn't, you know, Perseus on running around rescuing princesses, although he was the one who killed the Chimera, which is that mythical beast. And that name actually enters into the plot, both meanings of, you know, a horrible beast and also something that's really not there. So that's basically it.
That's cool. That sounds really good. I love the idea of it, the premise. It's neat. So the writing is going, like, you're almost done with it, or what's the
I'm almost done. I would be done, but again, you know, my younger self telling my older self, I, you know, because I moved to this new day job gig, I didn't realize that I'd be flying, you know, to the Armenian Azerbaijan border, you know, and
I didn't know you were doing that either.
Looking at minefields. So live minefields. So
that's your day job now? That's your day job. That was
every now and then. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so that was in the middle of COVID too, by the way.
Sounds like you have
that's rough being on a plane where everybody's supposed to be spaced out, but they're all packed together and it's a 10-hour flight and you're trying to wear masks, you know.
Oh man.
But it's tough when trying to do that. So
it doesn't sound like a walk in the park. That's for sure.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I just, you know, it me being a dog lover, I saw a dog or heard a dog blown up by one of the live mines. I mean, it was terrible. And, you know, and it's that part of the world where people just hate one another. And, you know, little things like kids and animals don't matter when you hate the other side. So
terrible.
And they hate each other. And it's crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. So, you know, I might have to back away from that.
I would think, I've been on Deadline and told them stuff like I got a bad cold or something. I never had to say, I had to go to like a live minefield.
You know what? That is the only thing that it does work. That it's better than a cold, or I'm having writer's block,
right,
or my family's bugging me.
Right.
You know, it tends to freeze people's perspective and they tend to cut you a break. But you know, right now though, it's do or die time. So you know, we'll see. They're trying to line me up to go to Ukraine because, you know, Putin is showing his ass there. And but I mean, I was probably only gonna be for like 2 or 3 days. I was in Azerbaijan, Armenia for about a week and a half.
Wow.
So
I didn't know
but you I don't think it's, stuff. It's good. What's
that? I didn't know you were involved in any of that kind of thing.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. I try not to tell them. I, you know, although, it, you know, I'm waiting for like the people in the thriller writers community to come and say, well, you know, can I come with you? And then we'll just like, no, you don't want to be a part of this. You don't want to be a part of this.
I was about to say Chris Chambers is the James Bond of the mystery writing community.
No, it is. Although this is a good cover.
Yeah.
You know, I'll that's all I'll say, but this is a good cover. But no, it's more, you know, it's more humanitarian related, if you must know, and conflict resolution related rather than security.
Right.
And military or diplomatic, to an extent. But yeah, it's the unglamorous part. And you're also dealing with the, you know, you're dealing with the James Bond types of the different countries that you visit. And they're either really, really happy and friendly and very charming, or they're definitely like, you know, Bond villains. So you know, there's that. So, you know, but hey, any thriller writers you want me to give you some info, I can be your source, you know, let me know. Just give me a little credit.
All right. We're gonna tag them when we post this episode.
So yes, definitely.
You're gonna be getting a million emails. Well, that is fascinating. You never know what you're gonna learn about somebody. And you mentioned conflict resolution early on, but I thought you were just teaching a class. I mean, not just teaching a class.
No, it's yeah. This is, they do that at George Mason University. They have a whole program, the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Center over there. They have a whole master's program on that.
Wow.
And we, you know, we're going to partner with them. You know, it's basically a skill teaching kind of a thing, but with me directly, no, it's right there, you know, on the ground, you know, listening to people scream at each other, you know, with guns. So, you know, it is what it is. Wow. But then again, I live in DC, so it's not that much different, except here they're speaking English. So it doesn't really scare me. I tell, when I went over there, this guy, the soldier, was trying to scare me. I said, look, you know, I grew up in Baltimore and I live in DC. Okay. Nothing. I've even seen your AK-47 probably before you ever did. For you, you know, you joined the army when you were 19 3 weeks ago. So don't even try it.
Yeah.
So
well, it's hard to intimidate city folks, you know, from a.
It is.
From the United
and country States. People too, because country people have seen some shit too.
Not messing around either. We're a tough breed, you know.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. All of this has been so fascinating.
Thank you.
And inspiring. You're an inspiring person to know.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So I really do.
Yeah. I've enjoyed getting to know you.
Thank you.
Recently. So, well, thank you so much for being on the show. And everyone needs to go out and get Scavenger.
Scavenger. Yes, that's it. That's, if you're the mystery fan, Scavenger. If you like anything else in comic books, and this is good for kids as young as maybe 15, Marvel's Black Panther Tales of Wakanda. So,
yeah.
And that's a pretty big.
Yeah, it's a huge
volume. And Scavenger by Three Rooms Press.
Yes. Everyone, I'm picking up, I have Scavenger. I'm getting the Wakanda book.
Thanks.
I'm picking that one up today. And we can find information about where you're going to be, appearances and things. Do you have a website or Twitter?
I'm doing a new website. You can find anything about me on Twitter. It's @ProfChris.
Okay.
And Three Rooms Press. And then on Facebook, I have an author's page, Christopher Chambers, as opposed to Christopher A. Chambers, which is my personal Facebook page, Christopher Chambers, and then @ProfChris on Twitter.
Okay. And if you get to be friends with Chris, he sometimes sends you jokes on
Messenger. Yes.
or events, which is cool. So, well, thanks again. And we'll all look for you soon. And hopefully we get to see each other again soon. Very, very soon.
Definitely. For a beer in Frederick, or definitely in the French Quarter in August. That's a given.
One of those FR places. We are going to do this for sure.
Yes.
So, well, thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.